All right, so it's not often that you hear sermons from the book of Ecclesiastes, y'all. People don't usually want to touch it because it's confusing. It's a confusing book. It's hevel, which is the word that we're going, it's a Hebrew word that we're going to come back to over and over again. Hevel is smoke or vapor, something that looks solid, but when you try to grab onto it, there's nothing there. It's an enigma, a mystery. This word is used almost 40 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. So why are we dealing with it? Why did I choose to talk about this at all? Why not just pretend like Proverbs, Lady Wisdom, we talked about her last week, like she had the final word, right? Because what does Lady Proverbs say? Lady Wisdom, what does she say? Go ahead, Sharon.
Be good and God will bless you.
Be good and God will bless you. There's a pattern to things in the world. If you're good, good things happen. If you're bad, bad things happen. And how many of you, when you hear that, go,
maybe not.
Maybe not. Maybe I've come across a glitch in the matrix, a glitch in the system, one too many times to let that have the final word. Have you ever been in the middle of something really hard and somebody says a truism to you? What's a truism? It's like it's true, but it may not necessarily be timely or helpful, right? A truism is something like, someone passes, someone dies, and the person says, well, they're with God. Okay, thank you. On some level, that's comforting, but maybe there's a time to tell me that, and maybe now is not the time. Right? It could be anything. It could be any kind of tragedy. Somebody says something that's true but not helpful. That sometimes is Lady Proverbs. Well, touch hot stove, you get burned. Well, it was hot, should have known better. Right? You knew the probabilities. Shouldn't have done that. Right? The idea in Proverbs is that the world works according to a pattern and a probability. And a lot of the time it does. Right? If I eat fire Cheetos for every single meal, how's that going to go? My fingers are always going to be red. Right? I'm always going to have indigestion. I'm going to gain some weight. You know why I'm talking about this? This is because Joy and the baby are out of town, and I've been eating fire Cheetos like crazy. And I feel guilty about it, and so I'm confessing. There are consequences to most of our actions, good and bad, is the point I'm trying to make. There are certain patterns and probabilities that we can count on, right? But like I talked to you in the very first sermon on this series, is that what we see in wisdom literature in the Bible is a conversation happening, in this instance, between three different voices. The first is Lady Wisdom. She's the idealist who walks into the room and she's got all the answers. She's like, well, you win some, you lose some. Early bird catches the worm, right? She's got all of these things that you're like, yeah, you could live by that. Life gives you lemons. Lemonade. Happiness is choice. We could go on all day with these little things that, like, you could try to live your life by that. But listen, here's what Senior Cynic, who walks in, but sometimes, Lady Wisdom, it doesn't work that way. The whole book of Ecclesiastes is him listing example after example after example of all the glitches in those patterns and probabilities. I don't have to tell them to you, do I? Because you have lived them. Or you have watched other people live them. Where the bad thing happened to the good person, or the good thing happened to the bad person. We could go on forever listing examples on both sides of that, right? Just in this one room. How many of us are there? 30 of us? Even if we just listed one, we got 30 examples. The last voice that we'll hear in this series is Job. He's Mr. School of Hard Knocks. He's the one who's He's sitting and watching Lady Wisdom and Senior Cynic go back and forth with each other, and he's like, yeah, yeah, yeah. You're both right. But there's more to the story. There's more. We're going to talk about him next week, so you should come back. Throughout each of these books, we're learning about wisdom. And the word that I gave you is the Hebrew word chokmah. It's not just knowing what to do. It's not just a knowledge, a how-to. It's the actual action of that knowledge. So, I can't tell you how many times I've worked with youth, and you can look straight at them. You can look straight at them, dead in the eyes, and say, do not throw that rock over that hill. So I worked at a camp in Colorado, right? We would rock climb and rappel. Clayton, you rock climb and rappel. If you're at the top and people are rappelling over the top, do you throw rocks from the top? Okay, I don't have to ask a rock climber that question. Everybody in this room knows you don't throw rocks over when there might be somebody down there, right? Look dead at a kid. Don't throw that rock. That's unwise. You know, you could hurt somebody doing that kind of stuff. So wisdom is not just knowing what to do. It's actually doing it. It's used a lot for like artisan, craftsmanship. This same word, chokmah, is used. Like the builders for the temple, they had chokmah, right? So somebody who's like an excellent photographer or artist whatever. Like these people, they have chokmah. Chokmah is not just knowing what to do and doing it. It's also this thing, this phrase that we see over and over and over again, fear of the Lord. Does fear of the Lord actually mean to like cower in fear? It doesn't. Then what does it mean? You know it doesn't mean that because somebody somewhere told you, no, that's not what that means. God is God, and you are not.
Does it mean the fear of
God? No, it doesn't. It doesn't. It has nothing to do with actual, like, cowering fear. It's more of a humility. God is God, and you are not. There is someone that we are responsible to, and someone who is responsible for us.
A healthy respect.
Yes. In our day and age, you know, sometimes that feels like a sign of weakness. Like, I don't want anybody above me that I have to, like, show some kind of respect to, you know. In our society, we want to be the top dog. We want to be the most respected or whatever. This is counter to our nature, to think of a being that is greater than us, that is above us, that we are responsible to. So the idea here is that God knows good and bad. God knows right and wrong. And we are responsible for trying to learn that from God and behaving according to God's definitions of what is right and wrong. It takes a lifetime. Some of it we know. Don't steal. Don't lie. Don't kill anybody. Right? And Jesus takes it a step further. Don't hate. Don't look at somebody the wrong way. That's the adultery one. Yeah, yeah. So it's not just knowing those rules, right? Wisdom is actually living by them. All right, now let's move on to Ecclesiastes. What part does Ecclesiastes play in helping us become wise? First, you need to know that there are two different voices in Ecclesiastes. Everybody with me? I'm feeling awake. You guys feeling awake? I danced at somebody this morning. Shouldn't have danced at them. It was too soon. Are you awake?
Amen.
There are two different voices in this book. One is the author's. They're kind of the narrator. You hear that person's voice in chapter 1, verse 1. Who's got their, you've got it, right? Clayton, chapter 1, verse 1? Chapter 1, verse 1? Yeah.
The words of the teacher, my son David came to Jerusalem.
That's it, right? He uses this word teacher. So you've got the, you have the author saying, hey, you're about to hear from someone else. We're going to call them teacher. And from chapter 1, verse 2, all the way to chapter 12, verse 8, that is who you're hearing. The teacher. Not the jerk, not the pessimist, not the cynic, not the critic. Who? The teacher. The teacher. Who is the teacher? Okay, so author starts, and then the author finishes in verses 9 through 14. The author lets the teacher talk only so long, and then he steps in and says, you've gone far enough. I'm going to wrap it up for you. And verses 9 through 14, which we'll read here in a little bit, verses 9 through 14, he says, here's how you're to be taught by all of this. This is what I want you to gain from it. It is the typical Judeo-Israelite idea about God. Okay? Got it?
Yep.
Author is bookending it. And who's in the middle? Not the cynic, not the critic, the teacher. What does the teacher do? Anybody ever read Ecclesiastes? Okay, you got to go read it. You got to go read it because it's going to mess you up in a good way. In a good way, it's going to comfort you and bother you. And that's what a good teacher does. Comforts and bothers. Teacher went, yeah, that's facts. So you don't want to just coddle, right? You got to push and poke a little bit. Now, Sharon taught. Sharon, what all did you, I'm sorry, I call you out on this every once in a while. What all did you teach along the way?
I taught the Bible and Greek.
You taught Greek?
Yeah.
Really? I did not know that.
Years.
Yeah, that means she actually knows how to do it. I took Greek. That means nothing. I know how to use my lexicon and how to pronounce the words and the alphabet. Anyway, okay, so when you were teaching your students, you're teaching college-age people, right? 18 to 22, somewhere in there. A lot of those kids grew up in church, and they were taught Lady Proverbs' view of the world, right? They were also probably taught Lady Proverbs' view of the Bible, which might go something like, God said it, I believe it, that settles it.
Lord have mercy.
So when Sharon stands up and starts saying true things about maybe how the Bible came into existence or how ideas have changed throughout time on major theological ideas, those kids who grew up on Lady Wisdom are like this. Dinner plates or angry. Right? It's hard for our worldview to be adjusted. What the teacher is doing here is just telling the truth. Just telling the truth. And it's painful to hear. Is it the whole truth? Is it the whole truth? All right. So what does the teacher talk about? He says there are three inevitabilities in this life. Country songs would say there's two. What are they?
Death and taxes.
That's right. The writer of Ecclesiastes, or the teacher in Ecclesiastes would say, the march of time is one inevitability. Chapter 1, verse 4. You guys with me? You tracking with me? All right, these are big bites to take. Chapter 1, verse 4. A generation goes, a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. I heard it said this way. You've got a problem? You've got a problem? Go tell it to the mountain. The mountain was here long before you. The mountain's going to be here long after you. Earth has been here long before us, and it's let me tell you, it's going to outlive you. Lord willing. How about this? Chapter 1, verse 11. There is no remembrance of earlier things and also of the later things which will occur. There will be for them no remembrance among those who will come later still. We don't know people from long ago. We know a handful of people from long ago. Right? Who are people going to know from the last 100 years in 1,000 years? Maybe nobody. Maybe a handful of people who wrote well. Maybe Martin Luther King Jr. Maybe Nelson Mandela. Right? I used to, when I was in seminary, now just bear with me. When I was in seminary, these were my ecclesiastical days. These were my Ecclesiastes days where I was saying, meaningless, meaningless, it's all meaningless. I'm in school trying to figure it all out. I can't figure it all out, y'all. I'm not smart enough. And the problem is you take one topic and you get smart guy A, and trust me, most of them are men because that's what we were reading, smart guy A, smart guy B, and they're on opposite sides of the same issue using vocabulary you don't know in sentence structures that are too long and complicated. They'd never get away with it in just regular conversation, right? And they disagree with one another. And you're having to make a decision about who's right. I remember being in tears in a class, begging my teacher, just tell me. Just tell me what's right. I'm tired of trying to figure it out. I am exhausted. Side note for you, one of the reasons I went to school, I was trying to solve God. I was trying to solve my life. Good. The teacher says, good luck. This teacher and the teacher in Ecclesiastes. But during those Ecclesiastes days for me, I would go jogging in a cemetery. There was this big cemetery right across LaSalle. It's huge, big, huge pecan trees. And I would go jog there just for the dissonance. Just for the experience of, I'm alive right now. I'm healthy, I'm strong, I can jog, but someday I'm going to be one of these. Which brings us to the next thing, the inevitability of death. The teacher says in 3:19, sorry this is so on the nose today, you know, but maybe it's good. For the fate of the sons of people and the fate of beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. Indeed, they all have the same breath, and there is no advantage for man over beast, for all is hevel, which is the word with smoke, vapor. All is hevel. The point the teacher's making here is that we're all going to die. Humans and animals. Now, there's one day out of the year where we commemorate this on purpose as a church, and lots of people across the world do this. Anybody know what day I'm talking about? All Souls. All Souls, Ash Wednesday. It's the day that we start Lent. And what we do is we take the palms, ideally. Sometimes if you forget palms, you use notebook paper. But we take the palms from the previous Palm Sunday, and we burn them. And we have these ashes, and we mix the ashes with a little bit of something so that there's some goo-ishness to them. I don't know what the word escapes me. Some substance. They're not just powdery, right? And the person, the people, they come up to someone who's going to impose the ashes. What an interesting phrase. I'm going to impose this on you. And they dip their finger in those ashes, or their thumb or whatever, and they mark a cross on your forehead, and they say something from Genesis chapter 3. Remember that you are dust. And? and to dust you will return. It's a reminder of our mortality. You guys, we don't spend much time. Oftentimes, we're not spending time thinking, I don't want to think about it. La, 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 la. I'm going to eat some more. I'm going to watch something on TV. I'm going to play a game on my phone. I'm going to take a trip. I'm going to raise some kids. I'm going to get married. I'm going to be involved in a relationship. I'm going to distract. Blah, blah, blah. I'm going to distract. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to think about the fact that I got this one life and I don't know when it's going to end. Are you still with me?
Okay.
Chapter 9, verses 2 through 3. It's the same for all. There's one fate, not just for humans and animals, but for the righteous and the wicked. Nobody escapes it. The third thing is, so what do we have so far? Time?
Yes.
And death. And the third inevitability that you will experience is life's seemingly random nature. Chance. The cynic sees glitches in the system. Proverbs sees life as predictable, probable. There's a clear cause and effect between doing the right thing and being rewarded. But the fact is, life doesn't always work that way. The cynic, the teacher, sees a glitch in the system. He calls it chance. In his own words, chapter 9, verse 11, I again saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, and the battle's not to the warriors, and neither is bread to the wise, nor wealth to the discerning, nor favor to men of ability, for time and chance overtake them all. You can do everything right, and it still might not go your way. That is the painful truth from the teacher. But you already know that. You already know that. You have experienced that. The point is, you can't control much of anything in your life. This is what the teacher's saying. It's way too unpredictable. If you want to master life, if you want to grab it and control it, you're setting yourself up for a fall. So what the teacher ends up saying is, these facts, time, death, chance, you know what that makes me think about all this? What's the word that's often translated? Meaningless. I cannot make meaning out of this. It is lacking meaning. Life is lacking. All of this means life lacks meaning. That's how that often gets translated. The word is a word, hevel, which you've heard me say over and over. Are you guys still with me? Every once in a while, I want to make sure you're not glazing over because we haven't gotten to the good parts yet. You know, we're just talking about the parts that poke and prod. Hevel is a word like, for example, in Ecclesiastes 1:14, it's where Clayton left off. I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is hevel. A striving after the wind. What I told you is that that word means smoke or vapor. I hope every time you look at a campfire from now on or some damp wood that just won't catch and it's smoking. My friend Joey and I, we used to light leaves on fire. And that's only smoke. That's the only thing you get whenever you, like, little kid playing with matches. Anyway, this idea of, like, just when you think you have it, it looks solid, but when you go to grab it, it doesn't make sense anymore. It's not there. Right? And this is that feeling that we have in life sometimes. We're oriented, we feel like we got it, life is making sense, and then something happens, or we hear about something that happens, whether it's to us or somebody else, and like, boom! Our whole world changes in that moment. We get disoriented, and suddenly we're in a fog. Hevel. We're in a confusing, disorienting fog. Hevel. That's what this word is. When you have those moments in life where you're like, I cannot make sense of it. too many times to count as a pastor and a friend. I've had people experience things that you cannot make meaning from. There is no explanation that would ever justify it. Ever. Awful. Tragedy. Accident. Violence. Things that are inexcusable. No one should ever have to go through them. And what do I tell those people when they say, why? Do I say, Hevel? No. They already know that. What I say is, someone will answer for it. God has to answer for that. Which really doesn't do much for you, does it? There's not that much comfort in it, honestly. The critic isn't saying that life doesn't have meaning. The teacher is really saying that sometimes the meaning isn't clear. It's confusing, disorienting, uncontrollable. You've had those experiences. I've had those experiences. And the teacher is honest about it. So how do you live life in the midst of Hevel? Pascal, Blaise Pascal. It's okay if you don't know who that is. He lived in the 1600s. He's one of those few people that history is like, all right, we'll remember that guy. It's because he wrote his thoughts down. So maybe you should start journaling or something. I don't know. Write a book, do a blog or a podcast like the rest of the world. Let's read it together. This is from Pascal. This would be a good summary. Everybody got one of these? This would be a good summary of what the teacher has to say, right? We are never satisfied with the present. Actually, John, do you have it?
Yep.
Can you read it loudly for us, just so I can have a break from talking for a second?
We are never satisfied with the present. We anticipate the future as too slow in coming, as if we can hasten its course, or we recall the past and stop its too rapid flight. We are so unwise that we wander in times which are not ours, and do not think of the only one which belongs to us. We are so idle that we dream of those times which are no more, and we thoughtlessly overlook the only time that exists. It's because the present is generally painful to us, so we conceal it from our sight because it troubles us. And if it happens to be delightful to us, we regret to see it pass away. We try to sustain it by the future and try to control matters which are not in our power, preparing ourselves for a time we have no certainty of reaching. So we should examine our thoughts, and we'll find that they are all occupied with either the past and the future. We scarcely ever think of the present, and when we do, it is only to take light from it to arrange the future. Mm. The present is never our end. The past and the present are our means. The future alone is our end. And so we truly never live, but rather hope to live. And as we are always preparing to be happy, it is inevitable that we should never be so.
So I printed that out so you could look at it again. That would be a good summary of how the teacher thinks. What time do you actually have? When Joy and I, we took a trip, like an actual vacation. And, you know, it's an interesting thing to live with and love the person that you work with all the time. Because what that can mean is that, like, your quality time together can become about problem solving, things that pertain to building maintenance or neighbors or printing the bulletins or whatever the thing is that needs to be done over here in this space. So we took a trip, and we were away for like 5 or 6 days, and we made a rule, a guideline for our trip. And the rule was, we cannot talk about what's coming in the next year. Do you know how hard that is? You can't talk about... What can you talk about? What? The present. Or you can talk about ideas, something you saw that was funny. You can people watch. You can enjoy the food that's right in front of you. What the teacher ends up saying, six times, if you want to go read through his narrative, what the teacher ends up saying is, yeah, you're going to have these Hevel moments, and you've got to acknowledge you just don't have any control over that stuff. You're not going to be able to make meaning from it. Even if you try, sometimes, can't make meaning of it. But then he uses this word, gift. How is any of this a gift? He uses this word, gift. The gift of God is to understand your inability to control life circumstances. That's actually a gift. The knowledge that things are going to happen to you that you cannot control. So things don't always work out. Chapter 8, verse 14 and 15. Don't worry, we're coming around to our conclusion. You guys are going to be able to breathe and go to lunch here in a second. Chapter 8, verses 14 and 15. 14, 15, yeah. There is Hevel that takes place on earth, that there are righteous people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked, and there are wicked people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. I say also, this is Hevel. But I commend joy. For man has nothing better under the sun, but what he's about to say is to be present. To eat and drink and be joyful, for this will go with him in his toil through the days of his life that God has given him under the sun. Damon worked 66 hours this week. Like, when did you sleep? When did you eat? But what was the question I asked you? When did you live? He's going to Disney World. I said, what are you going to do with all that money? And he said, I'm going to spend it. I'm going to Disney World. I almost peed my pants. I thought that was hilarious. That is like the textbook answer for what, you know, somebody wins the lottery. What are you doing? I'm going to Disneyland. We're going to Disney World. He's literally going to Disney World. Literally. It's not a joke. Like, he has purchased his tickets. He is going to Disney World. This is not, I'm not joking. He's literally going to Disney World the week after Thanksgiving. So, what the teacher says, the teacher's describing life under the sun. The way that the world works here is that it's unpredictable. And the very best way to navigate those moments of Hevel, put your feet on the ground, look at somebody in the eye, taste your food, be present, not off in the future, and not in the past. Be right here, be right now, even if it hurts. Even if it hurts. When you realize you're not owed anything, it's much easier to endure the Hevel. Go ahead and work according to the probabilities that Lady Wisdom gives you, but you're not owed anything. That's a tough pill to swallow. Because, man, I like to weigh out those balances, don't you? Like, I've done enough good things lately. This is probably going to go my way. That stuff is stuck in our head, you know? But who gets the last word? Is it the teacher? No, it's the author. The author steps back in chapter 12, verses 9 through 14. He tells the teacher, all right, all right, all right, that's enough. Let's rein it back in, because if you keep going down that direction, you're going right off a cliff. If you spend all your time with these existential questions, trying to solve them and sort them out, you're going to go crazy because you won't be able to do it. So let's read chapter 12, verses 9 through 14, John.
Not only was the teacher wise, but he also imparted knowledge to the people. He pondered and searched out and set in order many proverbs. The teacher searched to find just the right words, and what he wrote was upright and true. The words of the wise are like goads, Their collected sayings are like firmly embedded nails given by one shepherd. Be warned, my son, of anything in addition to them. Of making many books, there is no end. And much study wearies the body. Now all has been heard. Here's the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the duty of all mankind. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil.
This is, I love it. I love it that the author's like, here's the final word on the matter. The author steps back in. Here's the final word on the matter. But before he does that, I'm going to repeat myself. You can rack your brain over these existential questions. You could write a million books, and people have. And all you're going to do is make yourself tired. There are some things that are simply hevel. They are smoke. They are vapor. You will not be able to solve it or make sense of it. And then he says, the teacher searched to find just the right words, and he wrote what was upright and true. The words of the wise are like goads. What's a goad? Poke ya. It's like picture somebody trying to get a horse to move, and they've got a stick, and swatting it on the butt. Go, right? These kinds of words, they're pokes, they're prods. But then he was like, yeah, this is good stuff. It's helpful. But listen, you don't need to spend your life trying to figure these things. You don't got to do that. Because you might move an inch. This is why doctoral dissertations are so crazy to me. It's because people, they go to college, right? So they go to high school and they get that degree. And then they go to college and they narrow down to something. Let's say psychology, which is actually not very narrow. Okay, so they study psychology, and then you have to do a master's degree after psychology, because that psychology BA is not, or bachelor of science, isn't going to get you anywhere. So you go and get a master's in, let's say, child psychiatry in the school context. All right. So now you've done a master's degree in that. But if you're going to do a PhD and you're going to write a dissertation, you're going to end up with a title on your research that's something like fourth graders in Atlanta, Georgia from 2020 to 2022 who fill in the blank, who, you know, experience post-traumatic stress because of the pandemic. And you're going to have all this research that's a mile deep on this little bitty infinitesimal bit of knowledge. And you're going to bump the scale of human knowledge just like that much. And it's going to be helpful for about that much time. Now listen, I'm not anti-study, obviously. I think that there is merit and continuing to learn. So don't hear me say that, okay? Don't hear me. I have teachers in the room. I also like to read and learn more. But what I'm saying is some of these things are not solvable. Sometimes you can study and study and study and only move your degree of knowledge just boop, a little bit further. And then maybe you read something a year later and it changes everything anyway. So these are the painful truths. It'll destroy you if you take it all the way to the bottom. If that's all you focus on in your life. So in 12, chapter 12, verses 13 and 14, what we hear is the author's summation. Everything's been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. And you know what it is? Fear God. Keep God's commandments. Let God be God. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it's good or evil. Now listen, change that word judgment to a synonymous word in the Hebrew Bible, justice. You're going to hear it differently, aren't you? Judgment sounds mean. Justice sounds good. We all want justice, right? For God will bring every deed and make justice. God will take the hevel. Let me back up. The teacher described life under the sun, the present life. The author is saying, but there is more. And when that more comes, the hevel's going to clear.
The smoke is going to clear. The fog is going to roll away. The discomfort and disorientation and confusion and anger about all of the havel, all of the things that made no sense to you, God is going to make it right. God is going to somehow make sense of it. So although you may not now know how to do that, there is a God who is bigger than you, who can, and who will. God will answer for the things that have happened. God will clear the confusion. Paul says it this way, "For now I see as in a mirror, but then I will see face to face. Now I know in part, then," meaning lately, after we die, "then I will know fully, even as I am fully known." The next time you see the havel in real life somewhere, the smoke, campfire smoke follows you wherever you go, just by the way. If you ever sat around a campfire, it follows you wherever you go. Clear it. Push it out of your face. And remind yourself, that's what God's going to do. That's what God will do someday. Nisi. It's not all the answers, folks. But it's in the right direction, I think.